From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The island of Rapa'iti, 1,000 miles southeast of Tahiti, and the Pacific's last bit of land before Antarctica, is the ancient home of the Tahitian Choir. The 126-member choir of men and women, young and old, still sings today in a microtonal scale of quarter tones, rather than the traditional half tones found in Western music. The resulting sound is haunting, sometimes celestial, reflecting centuries of Polynesian tribal life in one of the most remote places on Earth. In 1991, French musician and discographer Pascal Nabet-Meyer first traveled to the island of Rapa'iti to record the choir singing its ancient songs, as well as those with a Christian missionary influence. The Tahitian choir recordings won the hearts of thousands of fans, including Peter Gabriel and the Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards. And the choir, with its members ranging in age from 15 to 90, still flourishes. Tonight on Point, at home in the South Pacific with the Tahitian Choir of Rapa'iti. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Pascal Nabet-Meyer, musician and producer of the Rapa'iti recordings. The original recordings have been recently remastered and re-released on the CD, The Tahitian Choir, Rapa'iti. Good evening and welcome, Pascal Nabet-Meyer.
Good evening, Tom. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. What a sound. And I have to ask you right off the bat about this plummeting tone I'm hearing in this choir. That's not your engineer playing with a record on a turntable there, I take it.
No, it's not, no.
What produces that effect of the... There it is again, the choir just sort of falling off a tonal cliff.
Well, it sounds like a vertigo, you know? It sounds like, yeah, a free fall, basically. And that's what their stories about, the tradition of their singing, as far as the old songs go. And there's a story behind it in terms of for what the elders told me over there. During the migration of the people of the island, they ended up singing the quarter tonal, moored basically by sailing the ocean, going back and forth between Rapa Nui and Rapa'iti.
Mm-hmm.
So the phenomenon of the waves on their canoes were just like falling to the vertigo. That's how they came up with the concept.
So you can almost feel the huge swell dropping under the boat full of people as they sailed.
Exactly. That's what's happening here.
Wow. That is an amazing effect. Place us on this island, Pascal Nabet-Meyer. 1,000 miles southeast of Tahiti is territory that not many people will have encountered. This must be way out in the middle of the ocean, not so very far from Antarctica at that point.
Well, that's the last piece of land, basically. You still have a lot of ocean below. It's a journey, you know, leaving Tahiti on a cargo ship where it's a boat people, basically, because it's a boat with no license. It's a journey where you don't know if you're going to reach it, you know. And there's no way to sleep. You have to be on the deck outside for 10 days under a blanket or plastic cover and pray.
Pray that you make it.
That's all you... definitely.
To Rapa'iti. It's a small target to sail toward, 3 miles wide, 5 miles long. This is a tiny island with a population today, I understand, of only about 300, which means that when you came finally in the early 90s to record this singing, it was nearly half the island's population that sang for you.
That's correct, yes.
You're clearly French, and you journeyed to Tahiti long before you made it to Rapa'iti. What took you to Polynesia in the first place?
Well, I was, you know, I was living in Paris, and I was really bored with the Western culture, and especially with the musical movement at the time. I was also searching myself. So I moved to Tahiti looking for a way to embrace the culture and also find myself. And I stayed for many years. I studied music. I taught music. I, worked for a radio station. I promoted concerts in the Pacific and did different things. And I met someone the year I got there, actually, in 1981, a friend, a pastor who became a friend after that, who told me the story about the choir and the microtonal singing. They had actually just performed during the July festivities in Tahiti.
Yeah.
That was the first time they were coming to the big island to perform. Mm-hmm. And they have a competition every year, every July. And all the islands come down. And every single choir has a chance to sing. And they sang the microtonal songs. And that was the first time the Tahitian people was hearing such a thing. And what happened is they were disqualified during the performance for singing out of tune at the time. So they went back and didn't want to. And I'm telling you the story because I've learned through the years what happened.
Yeah.
And finally heard the story in 92, and I said, but this is completely untrue. You have something very special, and you should keep it and keep singing the way you sing.
It's not out of tune, it's in a different tune.
That's correct. And you know, from that point, I think they came back to the belief that what they have is something very, very special.
The song behind us right now is called Te Matamua, if I've got the pronunciation right. And I'm reading your liner notes here. This is a song sung by the people of Rapa, or Oparo, another name for the island, about their first encounter with Europeans, the explorer Vancouver, if I've got that right, who made landfall in Rapa Iti in 1791. Am I correct?
Yes, you are correct. That was actually a song. What happened is when Vancouver arrived in the bay, and the Rapa people saw this huge boat, first time apparently they were seeing Western people, white men, went with their canoes and started climbing upon the deck. And the first thing they saw was actually men with red hair. So I suppose they were, most of the crew was Irish.
Maybe.
And they thought that they were coming from another planet, because most of the Rapa people have dark hair.
Of course.
And they had no idea a human being could have red hair.
The lyrics in this song tell the story very simply and straightforwardly. The first one who discovered Oparo, or Rapa Iti, Vancouver was his name. With their canoes, the young have paddled. There were 300. They were so surprised to see the ones on the boat because of their red hair. And then they sing, they are crazy, because of their red hair. That is why they are crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, it's very, very, they are very simple people in terms of logistics and the way they react to. They are really funny. They have a sense of humor. They haven't changed on this level. You know, they are really straight in terms of how they expose genuineness and again, you know, the way they see things very simply, you know. And I think that was their first reaction, very funny reaction, you know.
The story of the island's interaction with outsiders is not a great one. There were thousands of inhabitants, I guess, in 1791. Today there are some 300. Part of that was disease, but not only disease. There's a history of slave taking on Rapa Iti as well.
That's correct, yes. The slavery part of it, which came to a genocide for this society, or micro-society, happened in, I think, 1863. And they took most of the men back to Peru and Chile to work in the cotton fields at the time.
So these were Peruvians and Chileans who had sailed to this tiny island and essentially took away most of the male population?
Yes. And what happened is basically most of the women and children were facing their destiny here, and the population came down to just, I think, 30 to 33 people at the time, and they started from scratch again. And they remember it, and it's very well documented in several publications all over the Pacific, you know.
It's incredible. Nearly extinguished, down to just a few dozen, now back to 300. Is it a stable population now? Is the island stabilized?
Yes, it has. It is. The kids always come back now. I think what's happening in the last 10, 15 years, they send their children to school on the big island, but most of the kids come back to really be a part of this micro-society or the village and want to be a part of of the population. So it has stabilized, and I think from that point it can only grow again.
Pascal Navitmeyer, paint a picture for us. If we're sailing across the South Pacific toward this very distant Tahitian island of Rapa Iti, how does it present itself? What does one see? Is it tall? Is it like Bora Bora or a low profile on the horizon? What does it look like?
Yeah, it's pretty good comparison as far as Bora goes. Yeah, it's the same height, basically. You have two mountains and a big bay in the middle. And it's very, very... It's a tiny island. I mean, it's a little rock, you know. It's a... I can understand why a lot of people have missed this island. It's so tiny, you know.
Sure. With beaches or thick vegetation, or has it been denuded?
It used to have big vegetations. Not anymore. No beaches, no way to swim. A lot of sharks, big sharks around. Which is a problem, has been a problem in the last 25 years because a lot of people have lost their life fishing the lobsters and just spear fishing. And every year they lose like 3-5 people, you know, eaten by sharks. And it's a daily life for them. They have to take and go fishing to survive, and they deal with it.
Is it very different from Tahitian society, Tahitian culture? Is it a culture of its own?
It's not really different. They are more isolated. It's the same welcoming in terms of Polynesian society. They welcome you on board or at home. They open their heart. They just open. They give you everything they have, basically, and very genuine society. And the Polynesian people and Tahitian people are the same. They have that. So there's not really a difference. The only thing is the isolation.
When you first set out for Rapa Iti, you did some research along the way and found a single recording of their singing, and not of a full choir, but just of a few voices from 1906 on a wax cylinder in Hawaii.
Yes, I did. Yeah. Well, actually, it was not on the. It used to be on the wax. It ended up on a tape, you know, a cassette deck, audio tape, and that was the only recording the bishop had at the time. Now they have several recordings that I was able to do in the process since 92.
And were the islanders open to you recording their singing? Did they welcome it, your recording?
Yes, they did. Well, you have to go through a process of a... It's a very structured society, again, village. And you have a council of deacons on the island where you have to deal with the elders, you have to deal with the population, in terms of exposing where you are coming from and where you want to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was absolutely no opposition, in terms of recording the process of it, of living with them for 3 months and sharing everything, seeing the proceeds of, you know, the fruits of their work, of their art, music. It's been a beautiful journey as far as a friendship since the beginning here.
We'll hear more about that after a short break, if you'll let us step out for just a moment. Behind us, Ratu Kiota, song about the afterworld where the living are watched by the dead. It says, she is Vararoa, the warrior woman. She has been looking for her son. Oh, my son, I heard you calling me, but I hid. We'll be back with more of the Tahitian choir of Rota Iti with Pascal Navitmeyer. Let's go into the break, listening to more from Ratu Ki Ota. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with musician Pascal Navet-Meyer about the Tahitian choir of Rapa Iti. Here's the choir singing Oparo I Oparo. It's a war song. Pascal Navet-Meyer, I have to say, the top line of that song sounds like a very friendly war song, but then there's that ahung, ahung underneath.
Right.
Is that where the war quality comes in?
Well, you know, it's very similar to the Maoris in New Zealand, and Samoans, Rarotonga, Fijis, they all have it in the South Pacific, you know, and the homes are... The really male voices behind it reinforce the spirit of winning what you are about to do, and meaning your enemy, and come as a winner. What you have to know about the songs that related to the island is they were going through starvation. You had two tribes, and they were fighting each other for food all the time, which basically ended up the sovereignty over there, with the last king losing the last battle on his own. And that's why the songs, they are gentle songs in terms of pulling your spirit into the war mode and getting the power to really go on and win.
The spirit of determination.
That's what it is, really, you know. Now it's out of context, so, you know, it's a different story.
Right.
Seeing with love in terms of instead of war.
Not,
so that's a different context.
They're not actually going to war here. The thought of centuries of war on an island of 3 by 5 miles is kind of a depressing thought, I have to say. We seem to take that war wherever we go. The lyrics here, as I read them, talk about defeat and the loss of dignity and loss of life, but the loss of dignity that just lasts a long, long time. So don't lose, it seems to be the message.
They are really proud people, proud of everything they have, themselves, the way they present themselves, the way they think, the way they live their life, the family, it's a matriarchal society, and there a lot of respect for the elders, and a lot of dignity, that's correct, yes.
I hear something in this, echoing to my ear that's not well-tutored in the South Pacific music, of South African choral singing that I've heard. Do you hear a connection there at all?
I do. And I think it's only the beginning. This project is it's going to take us to another place, I think, in terms of a similarity or comparison you can have with other countries around the planet, you know. I think you're right. South African music is very, very close to that, too.
Can you describe the setting where you actually recorded these many songs? Was it indoors, outdoors, and the number of people there? What was it like?
Well, we were working at during evenings, actually, and we worked for weeks before we taped. Not work in terms of it was more trying to have myself feel comfortable with everybody, and everybody comfortable with me. So the process was long before we had 2 days of recording. And the recordings took place basically in the communal place, which is what we call in Tahitian Fare Amura, which is a house or room where everybody, it's a communal room, and we all come and talk and sit down on the floor and speak about what's going to happen the following week in the village. And so we share our thoughts. And it was a very simple sitting, you know. Most of the population actually was there, sitting next to me or behind me, and the choir was in front of me. You know, I didn't expect anything in terms of recording. I was just trying to capture the moment, nothing else.
It's nearly half the population of the island singing here. Do all adults join in, essentially, and sing?
Yes, adults sing. Choir is based on from 16 to mid-80s, I think, as far as age group goes. Then you have 1/3 of the male voices and 2/3 of female voices. That's basically the setting of the choir on 126 people.
And then it can be subdivided into many different groups singing different melodies, is that right?
That's correct, different parts. And you have one leader in terms of voices on some of the songs. And we have to go through different type of songs and explain as far as voices, how they go and take place into the setting of the choir, you know.
Mm-hmm. Men and women always singing distinctive melodies?
Yes, they do. And they have a song called Himine Tarava, where there is one leader in terms of voice, and you can hear it very distant, very clearly in the choir. And it's called, this voice is called Peri Peri. She's a storyteller. She's the one who, basically, she's a pilot on the ship. And everybody has to listen to her. And she starts and ends each segment of the song.
What's the name of this song then, Pascal?
On this one, Te Vaini Ororani, I believe. You hear the high voice?
Yes, in the background.
Okay, that's a Peri Peri. She's the elder. She has power over everyone in terms where she's sitting.
Is she conducting the choir?
Almost.
Is that her again there?
Yes.
Now, she's telling the story. This is a story of actually fighting over fresh water, which is easy to imagine is in short supply on such a tiny island in the middle of the sea.
True.
Says the story of the woman of Ororagni who goes down the crevice. You should not steal the water. Tevitau, armed with his bow and with his arrow, pierced her ribs and pinned her to a tree. There was only her pain. This is an object lesson. Do not steal the fresh water. Oh, there really is the soloist in the background there.
She's coming back in. Yeah.
You describe the island society as a matriarchy. Is that very apparent in the way the choir sings and is organized, in the way the society functions?
Absolutely. It's, you know, matriarchy and patriarchy, I mean, in both ways, from the father and the mother. The voice is given to the daughter, and the dad gives the voice to his son. And they pass on their tradition the same way, as far as vocals.
And in the day-to-day operation of the island and the interactions, most of the world is patriarchal at this point. Do you see, as a Frenchman looking at this society, do you see the greater role of women there?
I do. I think, you know, the mother, the mama in Tahiti, I mean, as far as the Polynesian society, the mother has the power. She's the one who decides for most of the daily life and has long duties and heavy duties, and she works hard for it. And I think that those families, most of the families, have many, many kids, and they are very prolific in terms of a birth rate, even if they stabilize the population around 350 now. But still, they really have a foundation for the family. They cook, they do all the homework in terms of taking care of the home. They do everything. It's an important role in the Polynesian society, very important role.
A lot of Westerners, I think, even now, understand or draw their images of Polynesia, Tahiti, from Gauguin and his painting. Mm-hmm. When you're on Rapa'iti, and I know you visit frequently, do those paintings seem that they're in a fantasy world of their own, or do you see that kind of image in actual life there?
You know, your imagination can take you anywhere. Mm-hmm. I can see that too, but I think those paintings are more in the Marquesas Island in my head. You know, I think Gauguin spent so much time over there that it was a different time also, where, you know, there is a, I think, it's not really in sync with the society in terms of visions. There's a lot of problems for me in terms of dealing with Gauguin and his vision of Tahiti, especially with a lot of... I'm not yet for censor anything in terms of art. Mm-hmm. Just he challenged basically the old society through the nudity of the way he portrayed women. For many, many Polynesians, they were really insulted by that, actually.
Are you saying he presented more nudity than was part of the traditional culture? Or
correct.
Really? Because, of course, that has fed this notion that this was just that these were the natural people on Earth and that they lived in the South Pacific, and of course they were nude.
Well, they were nude. I think, you know, they it was taken out of context, I think, in most of the situations, because he was sitting woman in and basically was a set, a design,
of course,
you know, in his head.
Sure.
And that's where I think some of the work has been misunderstood, you know, in terms of where he was living and how he was living. You know, my story is about living the life in Tahiti for so many years and living with the people. So, you know, that's all I can tell you. It's what I know, you know.
Of course, and yet I read that you, like so many others, were inspired in no small part to go to Tahiti in the first place by those very Paul Gauguin paintings.
That's really true. That's really true. But, you know, you experience your own experience with your own life. And this book was written 100 years ago, you know. And it was a different time. And I think Rapa brought me to the beginning in terms of where the book, you know, how the book was written and in what context, you know, in many ways. Mm. So I can understand both sides of it, you know, his vision, the misunderstanding of the people at the time, and if I look back with a different perspective, and embrace both, actually.
There are times in this music where the influence of Christian missionaries seems to flow right through to our ear. Here's one right now, at least to my ear, a song called I Te Whenua. It's, to my ear, has a very European Christian hymn tone to it. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, you're right, definitely right. It's well, this song is I Te Whenua is a welcoming to their land. Whenua in Tahitian, in Polynesian, is motherland, and it's something that you are. It's very, you know, you become patriotic, you know, towards your motherland. You respect it. You adore it. You do whatever you have to do to defend it. You embrace it. That's what this song is about. It's just welcoming the thought of, you know, having a land, mm-hmm. their own land.
But is this the traditional song filtered through or influenced by rows of these inhabitants of Rapa Iti sitting in missionary churches there?
Yes, it is, definitely. In my ears, you can hear it as well. Most of people would hear it as well. Yes, it is completely westernized in terms of where they took the song and basically took some of the lyrics of the Bibles and threw some lines into there, you know, into the mm-hmm. the notation. That's what you have. And this song, you can hear this song in a church in Tahiti easily.
And how closely is choral singing on this little island related today to the church?
Oh, it's very, very close, very important. There is no church. There's no people if there's no church, and vice versa. The church is basically where people can come anytime. Think that this the church in Tahiti is 70% of the population belongs to the evangelical church, mm-hmm. and that's very, very tight. That's the only place they can really feel that they can have an open discussion about topics, has nuclear, has corruption has unhappy with the new king of Tahiti. I mean, different things happening for the last 25 years, where the church has been left behind in terms of they have absolutely nothing. And that's also something that through music they can really think in terms of tradition, because they're still going through starvations as well on many levels.
Are you saying that the church is more relevant today or less relevant on this island? I'm not sure I understand.
No, it's more relevant to the people, has a meaning. Mm-hmm. The church is basically what you have, Tom, is your church is able to look back and see what the missionaries did to traditions,
yes,
right, and
yes,
cultures,
mm-hmm,
but also embrace the fact that from a pagan society, you have a structured society now through the church.
Mm-hmm.
So they have rules, which are Western rules, basically, but they function on a system based on the old tradition as well.
Do they feel resentment toward, as you say, what the missionaries did, toward cultural losses that they experienced as a result of the missionaries' arrival?
Not anymore, no. For the people I know,
mm-hmm,
who belong to the church, no, absolutely no. That's what you hear now. I think the music speaks on its own. There is absolutely no, you know, animosity or violence or regrets or bitterness about anything, no.
But I read in your liner notes that only 8% of the original dialect of the people of Rapa is still in existence. This song, for example, Himene Tatu, can't be fully translated, even though they're singing it so beautifully.
I know. But the original lyrics disappeared, and we had no way to really nail them. It took many months to translate most of those lyrics from me back and forth. And I set a point on boundaries where, you know, I have to respect what they have. And that's basically just what my journey was about, respect and finding something and try to bring it back to the Western world without touching anything.
We've got to take a short break. We'll continue our conversation with Pascal Nabet-Meyer. This is the Tahitian Choir of Rapa Iti. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Pascal Nabet-Meyer about the Tahitian Choir of Rapa Iti, a remastered edition of the original recordings he did of the choir in 1991, has recently been re-released. Here's the choir singing Tarema, a song about the creation of the island and the origin of its people. That is a beautiful tapestry. Pascal Nabet-Meyer, when you first brought this back from Rapa Iti in the early 90s, it made a big splash. It was number one on Billboard's world music charts. Lots of popular musicians took a strong interest. And you, of course, have a foot in that world, too. You were married to Ricky Lee Jones for a long time. Met her, I think, in Tahiti in the 80s. How was it received when you first brought it back to the United States and produced and put it out here?
Well, you know, a lot of people thought I was, like, tricking them as far as sounding and or playing, you know, a trick. I just said, you know what, I haven't altered anything as far as recording this project. I don't know if it's going to come out, but I feel like my journey there took me 20 years to do this project, and it's going to be heard somehow. I'm going to find a way. Most of the people have reacted to, you know, the story behind it, what drove me there, or took me there through this boat, and, you know, mm-hmm. being so seasick, and just, why do you want to go there? And just like, I felt, you know, I was in the middle of a crisis, and, you know, I think whenever you have a crisis, you know, something good happens. There's an output. And Rapa came as the good thing in the middle of my crisis, you know. The way people reacted to it, as Peter in Paris and Keith and all people
Keith Richards.
That I know, and in terms of music was, you know, those two icons in terms of musical mentors for me mean many, many things. And they have their ear very, very close to the speakers when they listen to something, and they can hear things between the lines.
You're talking about Peter Gabriel and Keith Richards here.
Yes, I am. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. yes. I am. And among others, you know, I think most of the people interested in music, or traditional music, have reacted like, you know, we never heard such a thing. It's just like, how did you come up with a concept? The concept is not me. Those people have it. And I'm just, you know, I was here to just take the journey and bring it back and share it with the rest of the world.
It's a fantastic sound. Here's Tamaki Ate Mau Ariki, a song that speaks about the people longing for the return of a high priest. And I read that the translation was not easy to turn this all into English, but I love what you came up with. During the ancient time, there was a war, the War of Kings. Then it goes on the sea, I guess the high priest, Huia, is having difficulties. He's looking, searching for life. Little birds, Taki Taki, are bringing us the news. Their tears are telling us Huia is still alive. That longing for that high priest, I guess.
Yes, the high priest, you know, in the Rapa society, as most of the Polynesian, they were drawing the map, astronomical map, for the people to be able to take a journey on their canoes.
To navigate.
To navigate, yes. Mm-hmm. So if they are missing the priest, they are stuck.
Yeah.
And the priest was really the teacher, was the elder, was the chief. So that's why they had written the songs. And when you compare actually Motori Nai, the first song opening of this show,
yes,
and this song, mm-hmm. it's about the same story, but the second song takes place in a mud which is completely different. The first one is a microtonal song. This one is more what a stretch out song called Himene Tarava in Tahitian, which means pulling out, stretching out.
Can go on for hours and hours and hours.
It can go on for 24 hours, actually, yes.
Wow, that's a long time.
It's a long time, yes.
Do the people of Rapa Iti leave the island? Do the young people go to Tahiti or to New Zealand and Australia and find jobs? Or do they tend to stay right there on that very tiny corner of the planet?
I think they have tendency to come back. They all leave in terms of the youngsters go to school, college, come back. All the people go to Tahiti twice a year or once a year during the summer, especially for the July festivities and all the festivals they want to be a part of, and also to see their relatives, you know. So, yes, they come and come back. Go and come back.
We're going to close the hour with a different kind of track. You've added in the new CD a very European orchestral accompaniment here. Tell us about this cut.
See, that's my part of the journey, I think. Well, first, this is an outtake of the last night, and meant something to me. Didn't make the album in the first place. I don't know why. I just came back to it 2 years ago. I've met, through my work, actually, someone who had bought the album many years ago, and through the journey of musicians and playing music I'd met a couple of years ago, Jeff Zinerly, actually a wonderful new composer. I asked Jeff, I said, you know, I'd like to emphasize the fact that there's a track here, maybe we can collaborate on strings arrangements and create something behind it for a new project, maybe an opera we could create towards with the Rapa people, with their dance and their story behind it. Jeff went to work and came back to me and said, how do you like that? I said, you know, this is so beautiful because it reminds me the time I spent in the temple and how I was 3 feet above the ground because I was in pure limitation with the music. And you really remind me, you take me back to my journey, and I the world has to hear it. And I think it's a beautiful piece and brings, you know, peace to your heart. And especially in this time, it's you know, I'm very affected with what's happening around the world. So this track is really means something for me in terms of peace, finding peace inside of me.
Pascal Nevitmeyer, I want to thank you for taking us on a journey tonight and for spending an hour with us. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tim. Thank you for the choir on their behalf. Thank you for the Rapa people, too.
Pascal Nevitmeyer, producer of the Tahitian Choir Rapa'iti. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
The economy is growing and people are finding work. Today, the statistics show that we added 308,000 jobs for the month of March.
We expect that Dr. Rice, who gave us very good testimony in the private meeting, will do that in public as well. And I think Tom and I have the job of trying to take the partisan edge off of these hearings.
We stopped briefly at a gas station, $2.37 for premium, $2.20 or so for regular, and rising. I'll tell you what, if the gas prices keep rising at the rate they're going now, Dick Cheney and George Bush are going to have to carpool to work.
Yesterday's events in Fallujah are a dramatic example of the ongoing struggle between human dignity and barbarism. Five brave soldiers were killed by an attack in their area. Then two vehicles containing four Americans were attacked and their bodies subjected to barbarous maltreatment.
Today's operation is part of continuing and extensive inquiries by police and the security service into alleged international terrorist activity. And I must stress that the threat from terrorism remains very real.
You all know that Judge Obis worked as hard as he could to try to keep this together. And the bottom line, he was not able to keep it together. And so he did what he felt he had to do. He declared a mistrial.
As of today, the law of our nation will acknowledge the plain fact that crimes of violence against a pregnant woman often have two victims.
During this investigation, inconsistencies appear between Audrey's statements, witness statements, and physical evidence obtained by our department.
And there's a week President Bush hails today's employment figures that show big job gains in March. Co-chair Lee Hamilton welcomes the White House change of heart in allowing Condoleezza Rice to publicly testify before the 9/11 Commission. Gas prices reach record levels and Democratic presidential frontrunner, nominee in all but formality, John Kerry, lays the blame on the Bush administration. A grisly attack in Fallujah leaves four American civilians dead, their bodies burned and paraded through the streets. A bomb attack killed five American soldiers the same day. British police seize nine men and a half ton of explosives in an alleged terrorist cell. A mistrial is declared in the trial of former Tyco executives Dennis Kozlowski and Mark Swartz. President Bush signs a bill making it a crime to harm a fetus. And police say they no longer believe the story told by University of Wisconsin student Audrey Seeler, whose supposed abduction and return captured national headlines for much of the week. But the bigger headlines, Jack, were out of Iraq, and it was not a pretty scene this week.
No, a lynching in Fallujah. Just as I was listening to that news, I was reading about Reconstruction, about one of the Colfax massacre in Louisiana, when over 100 black elected officials and others were shot down, bayoneted, lynched by a white mob.
And you're talking the U.S. Civil War.
Yeah, and the effect of these incidents in the North was that the North tired of their occupation of the South and pretty much quit it and left it, if you will, to the terrorists. I hope that doesn't repeat itself in Iraq. But think of the effect of this, first of all, on the reconstruction efforts. Something like 3,200 contracts are about to be let for various American firms to work in Iraq. Are they going to go to those? Are they going to assume those contracts? They've already had to cancel an investment expo that was going to be held in Baghdad next week. That may not be held at all now. And the effect, of course, on foreign help. We want foreign troops to come and take our place and take the targets off our soldiers' back. Mm-hmm. This isn't apt to encourage them. And finally, the effect on vulnerable, hateful minds in the Middle East. I mean, here is the United States humiliated. We've been made to bleed, and this just spreads a kind of contagion of hatred and desire to get at us. I mean, people say that Al-Qaeda, you know, got its first elan out of defeating the Soviets in Afghanistan. Well, now these sorts of, this is a mob violence, but this communicates to such people, you can strike at the United States. They're right there in Iraq.
Of course, the message from the U.S. Military officials there, steady, steady, boys, we cannot lose here. We cannot leave here.
Yes, but clearly they have something like a hopeless strategy going for them. I mean, they have, this was the third worst month, I believe, for U.S. casualties altogether. 5 U.S. servicemen killed last week in one incident. And, you know, if they get tough in Fallujah, it's just going to produce more scenes of mobs. If they don't get tough, they're going to allow perhaps Fallujah to become a kind of staging area for either a terrorist comeback or more likely a kind of Ba'athist Party rally. They're in a really tight spot. And meanwhile, of course, killings are going on elsewhere in the country, in Mosul. And within Baghdad itself, there are intersectional or interconfessional religious killings going on, Sunnis, Shiites. All of it very ominous. And, you know, it reminded me of a passage in Richard Clark's memoir where he says that the invasion of Iraq, in his view, was playing right into the hands of Al-Qaeda. And he says, Bush handed that enemy what it wanted and needed. It was as if bin Laden, hidden in some mountain redoubt, were engaging in long-range mind control of George Bush.
The Marines say they'll fix it. We'll be watching George Bush on the stump this week, Jack.
He was within the White House and at a congressional campaign dinner. The speech yesterday was on the signing ceremony for the bill that would make it a crime to harm a fetus. And there he was strong and moral and got tremendous applause. But talking to the people at the dinner that night, there was just a juxtaposition, really odd, between his upbeat tone and the terrible news that was in everybody's minds. And that's going to keep happening for the president, I think.
Well, let's hope that the terrible news doesn't keep coming. It's sad to see those bodies this week. Sad even for the Iraqis to be part of that. But we'll have to meditate on that one, Jack. Thanks for being with us, and have a great weekend,
Jack. Okay, thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.